We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Tonight, the low down to 42. Partly sunny skies expected Friday with a high of 65. Friday night, the low down to 45 with mostly cloudy skies. Saturday, mostly sunny skies with a high up to 70. Mostly cloudy Saturday evening, the low 52. And there's a slight chance of rain Sunday, mostly cloudy. Otherwise, the high 75, mostly cloudy Sunday night. There's a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the low 60 degrees. For Monday, mostly cloudy, a chance of rain, the high 78 Monday night, and Tuesday, mostly cloudy. There's a slight chance of rain, the low 60, the high 78. Tuesday night, mostly cloudy, a chance of showers, the low 62. And Wednesday, partly sunny skies, a chance of rain, the high up to 80 degrees. 61 on Fronts Plaza at 1237. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine at 1238. The U.S. Supreme Court has taken on some major social and political issues, but it has also received criticism for letting politics drive its judicial decisions. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer says partisan politics isn't that common on the bench. Breyer also says what is more prevalent are the justices' life experiences impacting their interpretations of the law. He spoke with Illinois Public Radio's Allison Cuddy.
All of us who have our careers, who have our families, who lived in this nation, tend to have sort of views that are what law is like, what the country is like, how law can relate to the country in a way that works well for people. Now, people do have views on that. If you were a lawyer, you would have views on that at a very abstract level, but they're embedded in us, and no one can escape that. No one can escape his background. No one can escape what he's learned. And at that level, I think it does have an influence in cases that are very open, as most of them are. Where you have a case that's very open with good arguments on both sides, I think your background does influence you. And I don't think that's such a bad thing. With a country of 308 million people who think very different things, I think it's probably good, even though I'd like always to be in the majority. I'd like everyone to agree with me. I happen to know, I think, that it is a good thing they don't always agree with me, and it is a good thing that people think different things. So I think at that level is where what you say is politics may come in, because you can't escape your background.
Right. How did it come into factor for you in a recent case, Chamber of Commerce versus Whitting, which is a really interesting case, had to do with Arizona law, which would require employers to verify the immigration status.
No, what I wrote in dissent on that, I wrote in dissent. You see, politics, even in the sense I say, you know, is not, and that's not politics.
No, but you were concerned about the possibility of creating discrimination, employment discrimination.
I think that was a question of who is going to decide. Most of our cases that are very difficult are questions like that. Who has the power to decide? The city, the state, the Congress, the president? In that case, I thought Congress had decided the question in their statutes. I thought they were trying to balance the problem of discrimination against the problem of illegal immigration, and they'd worked out a statute they thought did it. And my own view, as I wrote, was that the state law in that instance interfered with that careful balance. But the majority in that case thought, as they read this federal statute, it left open to the states to pass the kind of statute that they did.
Although you do, in your own understanding of how we should approach the Constitution, how we should interpret the Constitution, a kind of pragmatic or living Constitution approach, you do talk about purposes and consequences.
Absolutely,
right?
And that's that. I think all judges, when they approach a text, all of them have six tools, a right? Everybody has the same tools. The text, read the words. The tradition, say the words habeas corpus, there's a tradition. History, precedent, how's it been done before? Purposes, why someone wrote those words in the statute, what was he up to? And consequences, if it's decided this way, will it further the purpose or will it hinder the purpose? So everyone has that. Some judges emphasize the first four and don't like to look to purposes and consequences. They think that's too subjective. Others, like me, very often look to consequences and very often look to purposes because I think, for example, that most of the others are awash in most cases. They don't tell you the answer. Mm-hmm. But that's really the kind of way in which, on our court and in many courts, there is a division of approach among judges.
And a division that's been characterized as a living versus an originalist approach.
As soon as you get into sort of become pejorative or become emotional, you say, living, of course it's living. Well, fine. That doesn't get us too far. And if you want to be historical, one of the first things, of course, that Madison and Hamilton and the others thought in the 1787 is they want a document that will work well in practice.
I mean, that may be the case that you feel you're more in line with what the founders may have wanted or what the writers of the Constitution may have wanted, but the originalists make the same argument.
But how does either side know better?
Oh,
there's no answer to that question. Justice Scalia and I have talked about this in public, for example. He holds a different view. And
He has said it's a dead constitution, right?
No, he doesn't say it. But I'll say, look, George Washington very much thought about free expression, but he didn't think about the Internet. Now, he knows that George Washington did not think about the Internet. He knows that, all right? The people understand that, including him. But he says, let me tell you a story. And the story that he likes to tell is the two campers. And the two campers out in the woods, one is putting on his running shoes, and the other says, why are you doing that? He says, because there's a bear coming. And he says, you can't outrun a bear. He says, yeah, but I can outrun you. So Justice Scalia isn't saying he has the perfect answer to every problem. He's simply saying that his approach to these problems, in general, works better than others.
Are you concerned in any way about justices and the way they conduct themselves in relation to politics?
Well, I have the Code of Ethics. It's 7 volumes. It's in my office. It's called the Judicial Code of Ethics. And there are a lot of difficult questions, not too many, but every so often a difficult question will come up. So I'll look it through that, and I'll consult some professor if necessary. And there's some close and difficult questions, but all of my colleagues try to do that. And the difference with the Supreme Court and, say, doing it when you're a member of the Court of Appeals, as I was, if you disqualify yourself on the Court of Appeals, doesn't matter. One judge is as good as another. They will come along with a different judge. That doesn't happen on the Supreme Court. So you have to be very careful not to disqualify yourself. You have a duty to sit, as well as a duty not to sit in the cases you shouldn't.
Do you think this is a good time for the court, for the Constitution? There's so much debate about constitutional interpretation coming from all different parts of the political sphere.
And when I see that, I say, good. The more people, this is an amazing document. I mean, there were 4 million people in this country when they wrote it, and they were all pretty much, except for the slaves, they were from England, you know, and we've lived through a civil war, and we have a country now of 307 million people from everywhere under the sun, and they believe everything under the sun, and they've managed to live together and resolve their differences under law. That's an amazing thing. The advantage of having a country where this institution, the courts, will decide the meaning of a document so that the least popular person has the same rights as the most popular, even if because we're human beings, we might get it wrong.
Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer spoke with Illinois Public Radio's Allison Cuddy. Justice Breyer was nominated to the Supreme Court in 1994 by President Bill Clinton. Dakota Meyer today receives the Medal of Honor from President Obama. He is the first living Marine in more than 40 years to receive the nation's highest award for valor. Meyer saved Marines and Afghan soldiers back in 2009 during a firefight in Kunar Province. NPR's Tom Bowman has more.
Here's the scene. Shortly after dawn that September morning, Groups of American and Afghan troops set out on patrol along a rocky, mile-long stretch. They were heading to a small village in a routine meeting with tribal elders. Suddenly, everything went wrong. Staff Sergeant Juan Rodriguez Chavez had stayed behind with the vehicles. Here's what he remembers. Small arms fire in the distance. An ambush. An officer yelling into his radio, calling for help.
He's trying to call for fire. He said, you know, I have wounded here. I need to get him out of here. If I don't get this fire, we're all going to die here.
All going to die. So the Marines had to act. One of them was Corporal Dakota Meyer. He was just 21. He kept asking for permission to help the stranded troops. Officers said no.
And then finally I requested one last time.
Again, the answer was no. So Meyer says he and Sergeant Rodriguez Chavez decided on the spot to disobey orders.
He looks at me and says, let's do it.
That decision was the start of a long day, a six-hour fight to save the trapped men. Rodriguez Chavez hopped behind the wheel of a Humvee and drove straight into the ambush. Meyer climbed into the vehicle's gun turret. He says he tried to pinpoint the enemy.
Well, it was hard to pick who the Taliban was. You know, they would look like normal people, and the next thing you know, they're shooting at you.
They shot mortars at us, and then as we got closer, it was RPGs and small arm fire.
The Humvee side mirror was ripped off by the fire. The noise was deafening.
A very, very scary sound. Imagine one of those real loud firecrackers blowing up beside your ear.
Rodriguez Chavez said it was all surreal. Dakota Meyer kept firing back, the shell casings from his machine gun spilling into the Humvee. Here's Meyer again.
It's kind of crazy because everything slows down. It seemed like it was forever and ever. And it starts running through your head of, you know, I'm never going to see my family again.
Finally, they found the first group of men who'd been cut off. They were Afghan soldiers. Sergeant Rodriguez Chavez says they piled the wounded and others into the Humvee.
We dropped them off. Obviously, they were all scared. And they were like, no, no, too dangerous, too dangerous. Don't go back, don't go back.
But the two Marines did go back again and again. Which is why Dakota Meyer is being awarded the Medal of Honor today, and why Sergeant Rodriguez Chavez was awarded the Navy Cross, the second highest award for valor. Both men thought they were probably going to die that day. They remember having this exchange.
Hey, man, we're probably going to get stuck out here.
We'll just die with them, because I can tell you right now they're not going to get out without us.
They drove back and forth five times. Dakota Meyer especially took chances, exposing himself to enemy fire. At one point, he was hit in the right arm. On the final run, it got worse. Sergeant Rodriguez Chavez heard a report over the radio.
Like, hey, man, you're getting surrounded.
They were. Taliban fighters swarmed toward them, firing AK-47s.
A few of them that came towards the Humvee, Meyer shot them, shot one in the head. The rest of them shot him in the body. You know, they fell. From the front of the Humvee, they were about maybe 2-3 feet.
They drove on to try to rescue the final group of troops. Nothing had been heard from them for hours. Meyer said he hoped they just lost radio contact.
What I thought was, is they had probably pushed up into a house, maybe lost comms, and, you know, they're just waiting for us to get in there.
It turns out the